Gone South has been a podcast about crime in the American South. But for our new season, we're widening the lens. Follow and listen to Gone South Season 5, wherever you get your shows.
David Cobb is a college basketball and college football writer for CBS Sports. Also, role player here at 92.9 FM ESPN. Thursdays with Jeffrey Wright and company, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, right here on the Gabe Kuhn Show on X, David W. Cobb. David! How's it going?
Hey, it's going well, Gabe. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I want to say congrats to you and your wife. You had told me about this. I knew this was going to be a reality. But owner or operator of the new Chick-fil-A there in Glasgow. Is Glasgow or Glasgow, Kentucky?
It's Glasgow. You know, kind of like Scotland. Kind of like Glasgow, Scotland. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I got you. But congrats on that. Cool life move.
And I appreciate it. It all kind of ties together, right? Because, you know, when I left the Grizzlies beat, it wasn't like I was sick of covering the Grizzlies. I mean, I enjoyed covering the Grizzlies. I was covering Ja Morant's rookie season, for crying out loud. Like, it was a pretty sweet gig. But I needed something that I could do remotely because, you know, she was going out on this journey pursuing her dream of being a Chick-fil-A operator. And we knew to pursue that, we were going to have to move around. Well, if we were moving around, I wasn't going to be able to cover the Grizzlies anymore. And so I needed something I could do from anywhere, which is why a huge reason why I jumped when I jumped to CBS, which was over five and a half years ago now. And that journey has been going on. I mean, you know it, man. I've talked to you.
Sure.
I've done radio hits with you from all over the country. You know, we lived in Orange County, California, and Orange County, Florida, and just about everywhere else in between. Her putting in that time to kind of get to where she needed to be, and so it's just super exciting. I'm just super proud of her for seeing this thing through to the end. And the good thing is, we're still not too terribly far away.
Yeah.
She'll be in and out of town quite a bit. I mean, it is across the old state line there into Kentucky, but. You know, we're just a drive away, so you'll still be seeing me in studio every now and then.
Was it like a decade process to get to this point?
Well, you know, so initially when we were in Knoxville, you know, we came back to Memphis, or back for me. I mean, Sarah's not from Memphis, but I am. So we came to Memphis when I got the Grizzlies job, and Sarah had been in TV news in Knoxville.
Right.
And she kind of looked at TV stuff in Memphis and just decided that she was ready to go in a different direction. And that was 2018, late 2018. And here we are in the second half of 2025. You know, it's just it's a grind, man. It's not unlike any other industry or any other profession, or it's not unlike the coaching ladder, for example. You want to be a college football head coach, you got to pay your dues and bide your time, because you can't just buy your way in at Chick-fil-A like maybe you can at some other, you know, at some other restaurants. It's a little different. They really make you put in the sweat equity, and she certainly did that.
Yeah, so talking about the coaching profession and biding your time, I saw a ranking, a top 25 ranking of most overrated AP top 25 teams, and Brett McMurphy put it together for On3. Number one was USC, and it got me thinking about USC going into this year. It's a team we don't talk about a whole lot, a program we don't talk about a whole lot. But I would argue, I mean, we have LSU and Brian Kelly, right? We have Kalen DeBoer really trying to get it rolling at Alabama. You have a lot of different situations that are pressure-packed. Is there a more pressure-packed situation than what Lincoln Riley is dealing with at USC at this current moment?
I mean, I think you could say the coaches under fire in the SEC, like Brian Kelly and Billy Napier. I mean, you could argue that they're under more pressure because of the old "it just means more" sort of idea. Like, you can kind of suffer quietly at USC. But I think if you kind of flip the scenario and put Lincoln Riley's results into an SEC job at this point, I mean, the temperature would be as high as it could possibly get. I think he's getting grace because he's at USC and because they don't maybe care as much as a lot of other programs do. That being said, if they don't perform this year and are not at least at minimum 8-4, 9-3, like, I think you have to look really hard about the direction you're going as a program, because, I mean, he has really under-delivered. It's been a colossal failure when you look at what the expectations were for a guy who pretty much had Oklahoma at 10, 11 wins, either in the college football playoff or on the doorstep every year. I mean, he has not only failed to reach that standard at USC, but really not even come close.
Yeah, and the step into the Big Ten is maybe something he didn't see when he ultimately took the job, but it feels like that is the biggest problem. Every time, and this dates back to Oklahoma, I guess, to a certain extent, every time he is faced with that rough and tumble, have to be good in the trenches style, it could be on the road, at home, he seems to struggle. And that's what you see week in, week out in the Big Ten. Is that not the biggest problem or the biggest issue that Lincoln Riley has run into at USC?
No, I think that's 100% what it is. And it's the retention in the trenches. It's the development of talent within the trenches. And that's a tale as old as time, even dating back to Oklahoma. I mean, obviously they had Bill Beedenball and some decent offensive lines at Oklahoma, but their defenses were never elite. He was loyal to a fault to Alex Grinch, even at Oklahoma. And the difference was that in the Big 12, you could get away with it and maybe not win a national title, but do well enough in that conference just based off your talent to overcome some of those deficiencies in the trenches. Now, you can't out-athlete Ohio State and Oregon and Penn State. And then you can't out-physical the Illinois and the Wisconsins and the Michigan States of the world. It's a step up in competition. And I mean, I'm with you. I think if Lincoln Riley had known for sure that USC was going to the Big Ten, I don't know that he would have taken that job. Now, then on the other side of that coin, it's, well, if he had stayed at Oklahoma, they were going to the SEC, right? So, you know, maybe if Lincoln Riley has it to do over again, he looks for an NFL destination.
Right.
As opposed to staying at Oklahoma or going to USC. But, no, I mean, it's, you know, not due to a lack of investment. They're heavily invested in, you know, the NIL side there, and they've recruited decently well, but the style that Lincoln Riley favors is just flopping in the Big Ten.
Yeah, now let me throw you on, just because I was looking at USC's schedule when I saw all this and, you know, sort of seeing how many wins they could end up getting this year. One of the funniest possible scenarios has the chance to play out this year. Georgia Southern visits USC second week of the season, September 6th. You know who coaches Georgia Southern? Old Clay Helton. USC couldn't stand. Think about the uproar if Clay Helton went in there and even kept the game close against SC at the Coliseum.
That would be a chef's kiss. I mean, just that would be the most hilarious potential outcome, not just in week two, but probably of the entire college football season. That would be absolutely fantastic. And I mean, hey, who's to say, right? Who's to say that maybe they won't come in there and make a little noise, because that's a spot where, I mean, you're just kind of sleepwalking. It's week two. It's probably going to be a noon kick. There's going to be a half field crowd there at the Coliseum. I like where you're thinking. I like what you're thinking there, Gabe.
For sure. All right, now here at the University of Memphis, Brendan Lewis has officially been named the starter for week one against Chattanooga. That's the way it was termed. I mean, he's been named the starter, though, ultimately. And, you know, I don't know if you've seen a lot of it. I've seen some sort of dissenting takes out there. And the idea behind those is, okay, Brendan Lewis is 9-26 as a starter. Now, when you say he's 9-26 as a starter, I think you're leaving out an inordinate amount of context. Like, you're not even paying attention to the situations he's been dropped into. One of the worst, among a lot of bad times in Colorado football history, was the Carl Durrell experience, or experiment is probably the better way of putting it. So he was part of that, and he was inserted way too early as a redshirt freshman. Still, 10 touchdowns and 3 interceptions. Take that with a grain of salt. Take it for what you will. And then at Nevada, he comes in, and I believe Ken Wilson's the head coach. He doesn't play well. Then the next year, Ken Wilson gets fired, and Ken Wilson was really bad as well at Nevada, 4-20 in 2 seasons. Jeff Choate comes in. He has a decent year under Jeff Choate. But, like, I feel like when you get that dissenting opinion, they reference that 9-26. There's a lot of context left out of Brendan Lewis's career in FBS football.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, he goes from being one of the better players on a bad team to being the quarterback of a team that should be among the best in its conference. I mean, I'm really excited for him, because the truth is, he was a serviceable and competent quarterback in really bad situations without a whole lot of talent around him, without good offensive line protection. So what then could that player be if you drop him into a more favorable situation, right? I mean, I think that's what should probably excite Memphis fans about Brendan Lewis, is that his potential is still untapped, even as a, 23, 24-year-old guy, just due to the fact that he's never been surrounded by great talent or great coaching. Memphis will be a significant upgrade on both of those fronts for Brendan Lewis. And, you know, I think it's funny the idea that, oh, today we finally learned who Memphis' starting quarterback is going to be.
Right.
I mean, they've been telegraphing this thing for months. I mean, Gabe, you probably could have told us the answer to that question during spring practice. To me, it was abundantly clear when they decided to bring him to the American Media Day.
Well, it was clear to me when he committed, quite frankly, but
yeah,
like that, you don't bring in that 1 year mercenary. A guy that was wanted, by the way, by a lot of Group of Six schools and lower Power Four schools. You know, like, people did believe in the talent and what he showed his final year at Nevada. Like, when he came in, it was, to me, 36 game starter experience. It seemed like the writing was on the wall at that moment.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm so glad Memphis is doing this, because you don't want to just throw Antoine Hill to the Wolves. Maybe there's this expectation that because Seth Hennigan and Brady White did it, that just any quarterback can waltz in here as a true freshman and really thrive. But, I mean, that's just not realistic in this era. And you want to have a good backup plan, a good succession plan there, and this is it. I mean, you could maybe even redshirt him. I mean, you know, Antoine Hill could maybe appear in four games or fewer.
Yeah.
If they need a break glass in case of let's say Brendan Lewis's helmet pops off. Well, put Arrington Maiden in for that one play. You know, don't go throw your stud freshman out there and burn a game on his redshirt tally, right? So, like, I think their room is really solid, because you got three scholarship guys who you would theoretically feel comfortable with, and then you give your stud freshman a chance to maybe even redshirt, which, if I were AJ Hill, I would want to redshirt, because you preserve the window for you to capitalize on your NIL potential. I mean, we think he could be an NFL caliber player. We think that, but that's never guaranteed. And so if you can extend your college clock from 4 years to five, that's a really smart thing to do. And I think Memphis should be applauded for going out there and getting a vet.
And even if you're the guy that wants to, you know, in this fan base that wants to, okay, let's go with the future. Let's get him some reps. Let's throw him to the Wolves, as you just sort of put it, so he can learn along the way. Memphis is not in a position to do that. Ryan is not in a position to do that. He just went 21-5 over a 2 year span. And I don't see a bunch of people lining up to crown Ryan Silverfield and for his autograph. You know what I mean? Like, it's not a situation like it once was at the University of Memphis, where the expectations are low enough where we can plan for the future. We can get this guy reps. You have to still win here and now. You still have a minimum of 8 or 9 games that have to be in that left column by the end of the year.
Yeah. Well, Memphis is at a point as a program now where they don't get the benefit of having a quote, rebuilding year. You know, I mean, there's only a handful of programs in the country, honestly, that are in that category. I mean, it's your elite of the elites who you're never going to look at and give them a pass as a fan and say, oh, well, this could be a rebuilding year for Ohio State. For all intents and purposes, it kind of is a rebuilding year for Ohio State, and they're number three in
right.
the preseason polls. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you could kind of say the same thing for Texas, given what they lost. There's only a handful of programs, though, that we really give the benefit of, oh, this could be a rebuilding year for them. Or if they only win 6 games this year, you know, yeah. he'll be fine because he's built up enough goodwill. Like, you know, Memphis is in that category of programs where it's like, no. Like, you look around the neighborhood and you're like, no, we need to win 9 or 10 games.
Yeah.
Like,
and to the people that are saying, okay, I'd be okay with winning 6 or 7 games with Antoine Hill in there. Okay, you say that now. What happens when we get to the end of the season and that's a reality? It's a completely different conversation. You revolt at that point if they have 6 or 7 wins with all the resources that they've accrued over the years.
Oh, without a doubt. In this setup, too, it's you know, if Brendan Lewis gets injured or is struggling to perform later into the season, you know, you kind of give him a soft start, too, rather than just throwing him out there out of the gate. I've seen that go wrong. I mean, we talked about Dante Moore a lot, but that's just one example. I mean, it doesn't usually go well for true freshmen starting quarterbacks. So I think this is a wise move, a savvy play. Brendan Lewis is going to be, is he going to be Seth Hennigan? Is he going to be as good as some of the the great quarterbacks that Memphis has had over the last 10, 11 years. You know, I don't know, but I think he's going to be just fine. I think he's going to be just fine, good enough to get him to 8-9 wins at minimum, maybe even get him into a spot in the AAC title game. I think the schedule is favorable enough, you know, to where that's a very realistic goal for Memphis this year.
See, and that's the thing. I get the reaction by some in the fan base because of what has preceded Brendan Lewis. University of Memphis hasn't been in this spot in the better part of the 21st century. It's been Paxton Lynch for 3 years. It's been Riley Ferguson for two. It's been Brady White for three. It's been Seth Hennigan for four. Now you have this placeholder mercenary quarterback. People don't know what to do with it because it's so new. It's a new feeling.
Well, shoot. I mean, you go back even farther than that. Like Danny Wimprine had the job for multiple years. You know, it's just it's a program. Now, obviously, you know, you had your tail end of the Tommy West era and your Larry Porter days where there wasn't stability anywhere, especially at the quarterback position. But, you know, the success of Memphis football has largely been defined in this 21st century by four-year starting quarterbacks, or in the case of Riley Ferguson, I mean, I guess he was only 2 years, but nevertheless, you know, a guy who showed up and pretty much got the job and did pretty well. So it's, you know, it's a different situation, but it's not unlike the situations that a lot of other programs found themselves in last season. I mean, look at Ohio State won the national title with a one-year rental at quarterback. Yep. They brought in Will Howard from Kansas State, and no, was he Justin Fields? No, absolutely not. Was he as good as the long line of successful quarterbacks that Ohio State had had before him? Actually, no, I don't think he was. He got really, really good down the stretch and was great in the playoff, but September, October, November, he was not up to the standard of the prior four quarterbacks that Ohio State had had. Yet in the end, he led them to a national title. And I mean, there's no shortage of the other examples. You mean you look at Syracuse winning 9 games last season with Kyle McCord,
yep,
1 year rental at quarterback. It's so prevalent now. And it's these veteran guys who have been around and played meaningful snaps and seen the live bullets that you want to trust and roll with. And I mean, Brendan Lewis absolutely checks that box.
Now, onto another unsurprising quarterback, starting quarterback being named. We haven't caught up on Ty Simpson since that was announced by Kalen DeBoer. You're really high on Ty Simpson, though.
I am, yeah. I really believe that with the skill talent, the offensive line, the system, it's sort of tailor-made for you. I mean, especially if you're a former five-star prospect. He's waited his turn. He probably could have transferred out. I think that's where the questions come from. It's like, wow, if this guy was really as good as his prospect billing, then he would have transferred out and gone to win the starting job somewhere else. The counter argument to that is, when you're at Alabama, where are you really going to go? I mean, if you know that at some point you might eventually have the opportunity to be the Alabama starting quarterback, I mean, I don't blame him for staying because – yeah, okay, could he have gone out and fought for the starting job at Arizona or at Houston or at Wake Forest? Yeah, but he's at Alabama, you know, so it's I think that raises questions for people, though, about, like, why didn't he leave? If he's as good as we think he is, then how come he never won the job before? And I think the answer to that is, you know, simply, hey, this is a guy that was behind Jalen Milroe and Bryce Young. Simple as that. Sometimes the simplest explanation is the right one. And I think that's the case here for Ty Simpson. And I think he's going to thrive. I think he's absolutely going to thrive in that system.
Right. And here's the thing. Coming out of high school, five-star recruit, we know all of that. But he's tabbed as a dual threat guy. So, like, the legs, I think, are an underrated part of his game. Stylistically, what do you expect from Ty Simpson in that system with Kalen DeBoer and Ryan Grubb?
Yeah, I mean, I would probably venture to guess he'll look a little bit more like Michael Penix Jr. than Jalen Milroe.
Sure.
You know, you talk about a guy's dual threat capability. You're following Jalen Milroe. I mean, he's about as good as you're going to get in that capacity in college football. So I don't really expect for that to be a focal point of what they do with him. And you really go back to when Ryan Grubb and Kalen DeBoer have had their top success, it was with Michael Penix, who was a statue. I mean, I don't think that dude could run a 5.5 40. I mean, his knees are so banged up, and he's, you know, he's just not, he's not fast at all. They protected him. They let him cook in the pocket. That's probably the biggest thing with Alabama this year is, you know, can that offensive line be elite? if it's elite and Caden Proctor looks like a potential top five NFL draft pick at left tackle, you know, then I think we're talking about Ty Simpson as a Heisman Trophy candidate, because if he's got time to throw, I mean, look at the weapons. It's Ryan Williams, Jeremy Bernard, the list goes on from there. If he's got time to find those guys, yeah, I'm a big believer in the arm talent.
Mm-hmm. Now, final thing, Venmo and John Mateer, nothing burger, or did you read into this a little bit more? We had yesterday, for those that don't know, we talked about it very heavily on yesterday's show, but John Mateer was caught, I guess, on Venmo because people were looking at his old transactions. November 20th of 2022, he had two separate charges that he sent to his teammate Robert Roten that were titled sports gambling. Dumb as hell on his part, even if it was what he called an inside joke, you know, just joking around, throwing a random caption on there, which is not outside of the realm of possibilities, I guess. I don't fully buy it. But is this a big nothing burger to you?
Well, Gabe, let me ask you, for what percentage of your Venmo transactions do you actually caption them with something that's an accurate reflection of the purchase?
Never. Literally never. I put an emoji or a random letter because I don't even want to put a caption in anyway. And also, here's the other thing that I could tell John Mateer. Make your account private, please. Do that. That's the way to avoid this.
I've gotten a lot of people. There's other like politicians, celebrities who have gotten in trouble for this. I'll tell you the first thing that I did though when this came out was like go and check what my Venmo captions are. And thankfully I have the common sense to make mine private like 5 years ago. So, you know, but I put a pizza emoji with all my Venmo transactions. It doesn't matter if I'm paying you for golf or paying you for like pizza or something else. Like it's always pizza for me. I mean, that's what John Mateer should do, is just make it pizza for everything.
Yeah. Also just crazy loser behavior to dive into someone's Venmo transactions. I'm tired of this.
No, right?
Now, like part of me does acknowledge I'm surprised it took this long, but the normal, you know, regular thinking, common sense part of my brain says, what a loser. Whoever took this screenshot and put it out there is a freaking loser.
No, I agree. I think they got into Arch Manning's Venmos as well. There's a whole somebody has way too much time on their hands here. But I'll say this. I'd be really surprised, man, if John Mateer sent Venmo transactions labeled sports betting that were actually for sports betting. I bet what that was. I bet he's in like a fantasy football league or something with his high school buddies where everybody pitches in $10 for the winner. You know what I mean? And he probably just said sports. Like, because I don't know.
I
you know anything about Venmo,
this was like, my guess. He was a freshman, likely redshirting, not playing. He's in there with his roommate. They're watching the USC-UCLA game while the travel team's on the road or whatever the hell it is. And you get to about the second quarter. He looks to his roommate and he says, I think UCLA is going to win this game. His roommate says, I think USC is going to win this game. How much you want on it? How about $20? That's what I sort of – that was my speculation, which to me, I don't care. Like, that doesn't matter to me in the slightest.
Well, the thing is, they're not going to be able to prove from a Venmo transaction that he actually wagered anything. Like, there would have to be activity on a FanDuel or, you know, whatever your book is, right? Like to prove it. I kind of hope this blows over and it is a total nothing burger because, I mean, we've seen players lose their careers and lose multiple games in a season because of this. I mean, you go look at that Iowa scandal a couple of years back. That one got pretty detailed.
Iowa State, you know, Hunter Deckers was banned for life.
Yeah. I mean, I would be shocked if that's where this is headed. It feels so casual, so flippant, so insignificant. It doesn't feel like there was anything malicious here. But if I'm an Oklahoma fan, I am really freaking annoyed right now because John Mateer is supposed to be the guy who comes in with Ben Arbuckle and saves this thing for Brent Venables and gets Oklahoma back to respectability. And this is a massive distraction now, about 2 weeks out from the start of the season. And if I'm Oklahoma, I'm trying to make this thing go away really, really quickly because it is it has the potential to be a really bad situation. I don't think that's not my read on it. I think this is going to blow over, but yeah, it's certainly an uncomfortable spot.
Yeah, I'm much more interested in the amount of hype that I am not willing to buy into yet around John Mattier in Oklahoma. I'm just not there
yet.
Yeah,
you're not sold. Yeah, yeah, you're not a believer. I know.
I don't know if I have that strong of a take on it yet. I just, let me see it, please. Like, sometimes I don't want to have a take on every single quarterback in the SEC before the year. I do sports talk radio every day, but the step from Wazoo to Oklahoma in the SEC, we know that's a pretty substantial step. And we just saw a 5-star tab to be the next great thing at Oklahoma, and Jackson Arnold completely fall flat on his face. It's just hard.
It is. We're going to learn week two. They host Michigan. I mean, that there you go. I mean, that's as good of a defense as there is in college football. So that's when we'll know. Well, if he's on the field, you know, obviously sports betting is not permissible, so he's got to get past that. But if he's on the field, we're going to learn week two. We're going to learn week two if he's a real deal.
He'll be on the field. But, David, I appreciate it, man. Great stuff as always. We'll talk again on Friday.
Okay, man. Sounds good.
Yes, sir. He is David Cobb, college basketball, college football writer at CBS Sports, also a role player here at 92.9 FM ESPN. You'll hear him tomorrow.
The podcast Campus Files is back with more stories of scandal, crime, and intrigue on college campuses.
It is not hard to destroy a college.
It's almost like a university under siege.
Listen to and follow Campus Files, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Tomorrow on Jeffrey Wright and Company. Back into the Gabe Kuhn Show, 92.9 FM ESPN. It's time to take a trip around the National Football League. Connor, hit it. Poor Rondale Moore. Rondale Moore, I think it's the end for him in the NFL. He's been out for 2 straight seasons, and he's going to be out right now. Season-ending knee injury that happened in Saturday night's game, preseason game against the Texans. It's the second full season in a row. He dislocated his knee in camp with the Falcons in 2024, and I don't know. I would imagine it has something to do with that. Dislocated knees, they tend to come back to haunt you. I'd imagine it has something to do with that, why he's going to be out with the Vikings. But he will be remembered. I remember him at Purdue. He was one of my favorite prospects coming out of Purdue. He'll be remembered for that Saturday night at home against Ohio State when Purdue was able to win 49-28. That was an unbelievable game. But feels like his NFL career, his NFL days, going to be behind him relatively soon. Chargers running back Najee Harris is back practicing after the fireworks mishap on the 4th of July that led to a quote-unquote superficial eye injury. That is the most agent jargon I've ever heard. How superficial is it if he's been held out of camp and he still can't do 11-on-11s at this moment? Apparently, when he got the injury, he couldn't open his eye. He just now has started to be able to open his eyes. So I don't think it was very superficial. And for him, this is a really, really bad time to have an injury like this. Off the field, I'm sure Jim Harbaugh and the Chargers are angry about it. And they just drafted a first-round running back in Omarion Hampton. He clearly, Najee Harris, lost a step when he was in Pittsburgh. Chargers give him a 1-year, $5 million prove-it deal. It's a bad time to have something like this pop up, but here we are. But he's back on the field, and it looks like he'll be back to playing and actually taking some carries in no time. See, Michael Phelps showed up to Ravens camp to help them swim. They had a lot of guys on the roster that could not swim. But he showed up to camp yesterday. He was teaching Roquan Smith how to float like he was 7 years old doing his first swim practice. I thought it was pretty cool, though. Kyle Hamilton apparently beat him in a 25-meter freestyle. Now, Michael Phelps started incredibly late, and, I think he swam underwater the entire time just to show how good he was. But Kyle Hamilton, I guess, can take it to the grave that he beat Michael Phelps, the most decorated Olympian in U.S. Olympic history, in a 25-meter freestyle. Former Tennessee wide receiver Juwan Jennings and the 49ers are reportedly not close on a contract extension, and that is notable because Juwan Jennings was the leading receiver for the 49ers last season. 77 catches, near 900 yards, had some touchdowns to go with it. Tim Kawakami of the San Francisco Standard reported Tuesday that the two sides are not close on a new agreement, and he cited
that the timing of the contract request was too late. It was as camp was starting, so the 49ers are likely not going to agree to it. They better hope that Juwan Jennings wants to play out the rest of the contract he is on, or they are going to be SOL, quite frankly. Because Brandon Ayuk, we learned yesterday, is not going to be back until at least week six. Ricky Pearsall, I know he was a first-round pick last year for the 49ers, but we don't know what he is. They don't have a wide receiver room that's worth their salt right now. So Juwan Jennings is the one redeeming quality outside of George Kittle when it comes to pass catchers. And we have seen that if Brock Purdy doesn't have the full cupboard, it's not as pretty as it once was. He's not going to be in the MVP conversation. They're going to win six games. So Juwan Jennings, 49ers, make sure you get something done or it could get ugly. Shedeur Sanders. Oblique injury. Connor, you have surmised that it was the Browns that did something to his oblique so he would pull it so he would not be able to play the rest of the week in practice, and he would not play in the game coming up this weekend. That's what we figured out?
Correct. It's the only explanation.
Yeah, it's the only explanation. Just like it was week one when they were sabotaging him and didn't want him to succeed. He still succeeded, 14 for 23, 138 yards, two touchdowns, no interceptions. But he was throwing in the early portion of practice. Pulled his oblique. He was out for the rest of the session. Likely not going to play this weekend. Nothing to see here. It'll be fine. Jets cornerback Sauce Gardner was held out of practice today due to calf soreness, and head coach Aaron Glenn says the team is still evaluating the injury. That's not good for a team that needs to prove something this year. I'm not saying they're a playoff team, but they have to make some headway. The Aaron Rodgers experience was absolutely awful. And they have Justin Fields now. Sauce Gardner's a mainstay, seemingly perennial all-pro at the cornerback position. You don't need him out or hurting, especially with those soft tissue injuries, before the season gets going. Today, according to Sportico, the annual NFL valuations have been thrown out there. Dallas Cowboys, worth $12.8 billion, with a B. $12.8 billion. Coming in second, the Rams at $10.43 billion. Giants at $10.25 billion. Patriots at $8.76 billion. 49ers at $8.6 billion. The Cowboys have been ranked number one all 6 years of Sportico's valuations. Last year, the Cowboys were the first team to crack $10 billion, but they've gone up $1.5 billion since last year. And Jerry Jones still doesn't want to pay Micah Parsons. Someone explain it to me, please. Most rich franchise in the world doesn't want to pay their best player. Someone, please offer me a fair explanation that doesn't involve talking about how Jerry Jones is a complete, never mind. I don't get it. I don't get it. We get reminders every day of how important, how valuable a franchise the Cowboys are, yet Micah Parsons is sitting there without a contract and may not play to start the season. I know there's still some hope in the Cowboys organization that they will get a deal done, although they haven't even got back to the table to discuss. Jerry Jones is way too busy going to his Netflix premieres and talking about how I need to create sizzle and drama when it's not there. People are going to talk about you otherwise. You're the most valuable franchise in the free world. You're going to get the clicks. You're going to get the headlines. Just amazing to me. Just had to throw that out there. Michael Penix Jr. got into a scuffle today at the end of a joint practice that he had. How do you feel? I don't necessarily love my quarterback getting into scuffles. I don't love to see anything like that, but I like it. I really do. I like to see my quarterback with a little bit of edge to him. They're gonna be playing the Titans coming up on Friday. That's who they got into the scuffle with, but don't love it, but I do like my quarterback getting into a little bit of back and forth with an opponent.
Yeah, just don't dive into the pile. But you can get in a scuffle.
I stay upright. And I saw Michael Penix after when they were asking him about it. He basically said, throws a touchdown pass, starts jawing back and forth with Titans DBs, and then he said he blacked out. Okay. I love that for you. Love that intensity. Make sure it carries over into the season. But that will do it for a trip around the National Football League. One more segment left in hour number two. We'll get to that next with Small Talk right here on the Gabe Kuhn Show, 92.9 FM ESPN.
And Small Talk is brought to you by Conway Services, reputable service available 7 days a week. Now, we are about a year removed from Jontay Porter being banned for life from the National Basketball Association for a gambling scheme, his role in a gambling scheme. Jontay Porter admitted in court in July of 2024 to removing himself from two games during the 23-24 season to benefit associates who had bet on the under on his statistics. He said the scheme was designed to pay off gambling debts. Now, Jontay Porter has an older brother by the name of Michael Porter Jr., who plays for the Nets, obviously just coming over from the Denver Nuggets. He won a championship with them. But Michael Porter Jr. was doing the podcast rounds this week, and he spoke up on the proliferation of sports gambling and how it has affected his brother, and called it a vice of Jontay's, and it always has been a vice of Jontay's. But then he went on to say the enjoyment of the game isn't for the game anymore. It's so that people can make money. In reality, way more people are losing money than making money. He went on to say, think about it. If you could get all your homies rich by telling them, yo, bet $10,000 on my under this one game, I'm going to act like I've got an injury, and I'm going to sit out. I'm going to come out after 3 minutes, and they all get a little bag because you did it in one game. That is so not okay, but some people probably think like that. They come from nothing, and all their homies have nothing. These are fair points, without question. We know, though, what's legal and what's not legal. But I do want to focus on the first part of what he had to say. The enjoyment of the game isn't for the game anymore. I would be lying to you if I told you I didn't feel some of that on a night-to-night basis. I think it's less and less about favorite teams and rooting against your least favorite teams. And it is more about, if you are a very avid sports gambler, which a lot of our population that watches sports is, it's more about how much can I make out of this game? What's that matchup look like? Who did I bet on? What's the over? What's the under? And I think that that is one of the unintended consequences that has come from how widely, you know, saturated and thrown out the gambling market is, and how many different.
How We Made Your Mother is a rewatch podcast that looks back episode by episode at the hit TV show How I Met Your Mother. It's hosted by me, Josh Radner, along with series co-creator Craig Thomas.
In seasons 1 and 2, we were joined by Neil Patrick Harris, Kobe Smulders, Bryan Cranston, Ashley Williams, Wayne Brady, Jenna Fisher and Angela Kinsey, Joe Manganiello, and my brilliant co-creator Carter Bays. And now we are diving into season 3.
So whether it's your 50th rewatch or your first time through, follow How We Made Your Mother wherever you get your podcasts.
Books people have, how many different games they bet on. I think that there is a lot of truth to what Michael Porter Jr. said.
No, I think that it's one of the few things that Michael Porter Jr. has ever said that made a ton of sense.
Correct.
Like, to be honest, it was kind of shocking that it came from. Now, what's very funny is that this is amongst just him basically making fun of his brother in a couple of ways, but I do think that he is making some very good points here. We had a pretty good example of it, I think, last Friday when the Lions played in their preseason game. You know, one of their players had to be carted off of the field. And when the NFL posted about it, when the Lions posted about it, if you go to the comments on social media, because the teams decided just to run out the clock for the final 6:30 of the game because it's a preseason game and it does not matter. They don't want anybody else being seriously injured. After this, watching a player get carted off the field, you had people saying, well, how's this going to affect gambling? Are they going to refund my
bet?
Just a human that had to be carted off the field. Nobody cares about him. All they care about is how it impacted their money. And listen, you and I, we go out a lot. We're around the city a whole bunch. People come up to us. We have conversations about sports. And this is not me just making this up. People have talked to me about, well, if a team wins but they don't cover, I don't consider it a win. What are you talking about? What are you talking about?
I would venture to say 99% of the actual sports talk that I have with my buddies these days has to do about sports wagering and gambling. There's some other, like, obviously when there's scandals that pop up, we can dive into that.
Sure.
We have conversations. But I would say 95% of the conversations via text, via phone, that I have with friends are about what type of pick should I make tonight? Who's going to win? What matchups do you like coming up this weekend in the NFL? And it didn't used to be that way at all. Like, that was a rarity to even have that conversation. And I remember, like, growing up, did you even
were you even aware of lines of games?
I did not learn about...
Or money line or what everything looked like, over-unders,
I did
totals.
Not have to learn about gambling. When I say had to, we have to know about these things.
Yeah,
we have to know what's going on to be able to do our jobs. I didn't have to learn about it until I started being on air for 929. And it wasn't even the first few years I was on air. Like, when I was with Eric Hasseltine in the first few years with Jeffrey and Giannotto, I don't think that we were talking about gambling as much. And then when it became legalized, it became a requirement to be able to talk about these games. If you go to ESPN right now, any game that you click on, one of the first things that you're going to see is the money line and the line. That's what you're going to see.
Yeah. I was never aware of them. I can say this pretty
never
positively.
Aware. Was never aware.
When I was playing football at the University of Memphis, never aware of what the line was ever in my life. Didn't even think about it.
If you're tweeting at an athlete, especially a college athlete, about they didn't cover or they didn't hit some over-under on stats, you're a loser.
Well, yeah.
That's the biggest loser behavior
I mean, we had guys digging into John Mateer's Venmo. I mean, there's a lot of losers.
That's more funny.
It's funny.
But it
it's
is
also
loser behavior.
For sure. All right, hour number three is on the way. We have some college football to talk and some Brendan Lewis to talk because he got to watch him at Colorado with my guy Colton Denning. So let's go ahead and get to that next right here on the Gabe Kuhn Show, 92.9 FM ESPN.
I'm Tobin Heath.
And I'm Kristen Press.
We're World Cup champions, Olympians, and the hosts of The Recap Show.
Week in and week out, we sit down with sports legends, cultural icons, and global changemakers to talk everything from clutch games to causes that matter. This is about creating the future of women's sports, a future that's honest, inclusive, and real.
Join us for our reimagined journey. Follow and listen to The Recap Show wherever you get your podcasts.